That's the Take Back September 11 for Nonviolence Rally, Thursday, September 11, from 3 to 5 p.m.
Stars in the PM, and I love the sunrise, so I step out in the AM. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation. Mornings fresh, oxygen cleanest. I take a deep hit, help my mind stay the greenest. I'm already awake, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store.
Good evening. This is Michael Anderson, and you are listening to KBOO FM 90.7 on your dial here in Portland. This is your community radio station, and this is Hole in the Bucket, KBOO's show about poverty, housing, and homelessness. Tonight we have two portions of the show. The first portion of the show, I'm going to be joined in the studio by Israel Baer from Street Roots, and we're going to talk about the mounting tensions on the east side of the river in Portland as the downtown core has been systematically moving out people who are homeless over the last, well, geez, as long as I can remember. But they've been doing it better recently, and it's beginning to show up in people now living on the east side. Then the second half of the show, we're going to talk about another alarming trend, which is the Department of Education for the state of Oregon released their numbers for homeless students enrolled in school this past year. And in the last 5 years, we've seen the number of homeless students in Oregon schools double. I'll say that one more time. The kids who are trying to go and learn and build a life and build a future, the amount of them that are homeless and trying to take on this task has doubled in the last 5 years. All right. Disgust me. But who doesn't disgust me is Israel Baer, who's kind enough to join us. He's been an oftentimes guest here on Hole in the Bucket, sister in the voice of homelessness, really a leader in our community with Street Roots. And welcome to the studio tonight, Israel.
Thank you.
So the latest Street Roots came out on Friday. The lead story was about Henry Rollins, but the other main front page story was about the growing tensions on the east side. And let's just start there. What's going on the east side of the river in Portland?
Well, am I live?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. On the east side of Portland, over the last several months, there's been a systematic moving of individuals on the streets downtown. Many of the laws that are enforced against individuals on the streets have pushed individuals to the east side of the river. And this summer, there's been camps upwards of 100 individuals off of the East Bank Esplanade. And there's just tensions mounting between individuals on the streets, local businesses, the East Side Industrial Council. So there's there's really a feeling on the streets of where else are we going to go. And so a lot of individuals on that side of the river are now caught between downtown, that side of the river, and where exactly they're going to go.
I think probably many folks who are familiar with Portland in the summertime know that certainly, I guess, in the spring, before the festival season starts, but then after the major festivals subside, the way it has been most of the time that I lived in Portland is you could go under the Burnside Bridge and the Morrison Bridge, and there was evidence, the Steel Bridge to a certain degree, evidence that there was a lot of people that was the primary place that they were sleeping, residing, spending time. But that's changed.
There's in late August, the Portland Patrol Incorporated were hired by the East Side Industrial Business Council to actually patrol the east side of the river from I-84 to Powell, from the river to 12th Avenue. So a lot of individuals who have been more or less given a safe zone to camp out and sleep that don't have anywhere else to go in the city are now being asked to move along and move out of the area.
Now, of course, anytime you're talking about hundreds of people, and I believe that there's at least two camps that have about 100 people.
It varies. They go up and down. It's peaks and valleys. Currently, there's scattered camps, and they've been able to move some of those individuals out of there.
But I guess I would say, as we know, any time when we're talking about even a small group of people, but certainly with a large group of people, there's an impact when there's a lot of people. People have their daily functions that they need to take care of, a place to lie down, a place to go to the bathroom, a place to dispose of waste. That's been some of the reasons that we've seen this heightened tension.
That's correct. If you go and walk the East Bank Esplanades and the parking lots and the area adjacent to the Esplanade itself, there's a lot of trash, so there's a lot of waste, and it's created a real tension with a lot of the local business community. So there's not a lot of coordination between the Parks Department, the city, police, social service agencies to actually keep that area clean. So in essence, it's been a dumping ground for the city of Portland to allow people to go there. And they do have toilets in that area. But as far as being able to coordinate trash pickup, things of that nature, really people are lacking the tools to be able to keep their own areas clean. And so that's part of the reason you've seen a heightened tension.
One of the things that I noticed from the article, and if for our listeners out here, if you haven't picked up the latest copy of Street Roots, you should. One of the things that the article talked about is business owners talking about property damage. It seemed almost that people were feeling threatened. What did you find out about that in terms of some examples of what type of things are concerning these business owners?
Well, one business owner that talked to us off the record felt like, I believe to quote her, she said that she felt like she was walking the gauntlet when she walked from actually downtown to her business in the Inner East Side. So she said that, you know, she felt overwhelmed by the amount of people that she had to encounter just on her walk from downtown over to the East Side. So, you know, I think that when we create an atmosphere in Portland that certain regions of the city are off limits to be able to have your basic needs met, sleep, using the restroom, life functions, and we create one area that is basically a dumping ground for that, we create an atmosphere that doesn't allow for a sharing of the resources. And, you know, with all due respect to a lot of people on the streets, the area over there is chaotic. It's filled with trash. Anyone could walk over there and say this is a nightmare, you know, happening. It's a train wreck. So, you know, I think that it really what it boils down to is getting back to the idea of there needs to be a lot more leadership through the city to know actually what's happening on the ground in certain regions, because these things, it's shifting sands, and large groups of people that are moved from one area to another in the city, these things happen overnight, and it needs to be coordinated in a much more, a better fashion, so we can allow for individuals on the streets to take care of themselves and to exist, but to not put the burden off on one particular neighborhood or another.
So it wasn't too long ago, maybe some 18 months, that we had you on the show along with some staff from the Bureau of Housing and Community Development to talk about the 10-year plan. And at that point, the city was touting some fairly impressive numbers about the way that they had reduced homelessness in the city. How do these two things fit together, the 10-year plan and these folks that are on the East Side? Are they new people to the city?
Well, we can't necessarily speak to whether individuals on the streets are new or not. I think one of the tensions that arose that what we saw in the 3-week protest in front of City Hall, when a lot of individuals on the streets actually started squatting in front of City Hall demanding their civil rights and that they not be pushed from one region of the city to another, is what came out of that discussion and what came out of those protests is the idea that the 10-year plan has a very long-term goal of being able to house X amount of people over a longer period of time, but there's not the short-term strategy in place to be able to work with individuals. So some interest in the city believe we should have more shelters. Some interest believe we should do more harm reduction. The 10-year plan people are really focused on long-term housing. And currently, with the dire need on the streets, there's not that short-term strategy in place that allows us to be able to work with individuals in a way where we can, it can be a positive influence on their lives. So, you know, right now it's a train wreck.
One of the critiques that we've expressed many times on Hole in the Bucket of the 10-year plan is that some of the assumptions on which it's hinged seem to be very tenuous, or they sound good in the abstract, but in principle they're going to create quite a challenge, the central piece of which is the 10-year plan, as it was explained in its federal concept, and even in the city, was that we're going to work on those who are quote-unquote chronically homeless first. We're going to house them because they're the high users of the system, and then we're going to save enough resources in the system, we're going to be able to help everyone else. One of the parts I've always struggled with is the concept that you could hit a pause button on the lives of everyone else for 10 years while you got together the resources to house the chronically homeless. And it seems to me, to a certain degree, whether we're talking about the protest outside of City Hall or these tensions on the east side, that in some ways this is a manifestation of there's still inadequate resources to be serious about offering people an opportunity to get out of homelessness.
That's correct. And I think for the foreseeable future, there are going to be those lack of resources. And that's why so many groups continue to urge City Hall to show leadership in creating some alternative out of the box harm reduction models to work with individuals on the streets. Right now, you're basically heavy enforcement of individuals on the street is being done by the police bureau and private security services downtown, and now you're seeing that leak over into the east side. And so that's really not an answer. That's really creating it's actually undercutting the work of the 10-year plan, and it's creating an atmosphere where we don't have the resources on one hand, but on the other we're saying that you can't be here. So there really needs to be some leadership shown in a way that people can get their hands dirty and get down in the trenches and really find some strategic ways to work with people that doesn't include all criminalization or shelters which don't meet the need of individuals on the streets always while housing is being developed.
So one of the things that I've also really struggled with, looking at the again, I've been living in Portland now for, 16 years, and I started out. My first job was in Old Town, and at that point, the light rail had just been put in, and the full on cleanup had begun maybe 3 years before, but we hadn't seen the large scale evacuation of people who are homeless from the downtown area. Now they're on the east side. There's mounting tensions. Have you talked to anyone in City Hall who's made a suggestion of where there would be a place where all these hundreds of people could go?
You know, I think that right now all the balls are up in the air. There's a lot of different opinions and philosophies about how we should handle the situation. I think what ends up happening is the individuals who are experiencing homelessness are faced with dealing with really faulty enforcement by the police bureau and the private security services that can offer real-time solutions in the context of what I've heard called the five-minute plan, which the five-minute plan says you need to pack your gear up and you need to go that way or that way. And so really there's not a lot of answers in the context of short-term strategies. It's very frustrating.
One of the other things that I find quite a conundrum is that, so, you know, downtown, certainly there's some residential downtown. In the close, in east side, there's a smattering of residential. But mostly we're talking about a business sector. It seems to me, if we're not going to allow people who are homeless to live in the business sector, the next place is the residential neighborhoods.
Well, that's the big question, and I think that in the coming months, that if individuals aren't allowed some leeway in being able to exist in some of the more non-traditional areas of the city that aren't residential, that that's something that the residential communities are going to be facing.
What really concerns me about this, and this is, a subject we've touched on a lot on the show, but especially now as we're heading into what's turning out to be a somewhat absurd election season, I think it's important to mention again that from the perspective of this show, Jay Thiemeyer and I, as we've talked about this issue, but I think there's certainly other folks like yourself who share this analysis, that the 10-year plan's a little bit of a setup. It was introduced nationally by a Republican government that has been very straightforward in their desire to demonstrate that domestic programs are not the purview of the government, that the government is a failure at providing a social safety net. And they have, as Frank Luntz says, you know, drowned the government in the bathtub, or you know, whatever his classic phrase is. What I worry about here is as people who are homeless go into residential neighborhoods where, by and large, people may have very little understanding of what these people's experience is or why they're winding up sleeping on their front lawn or tucked under their bushes, that what's going to happen is that there's going to be a public lashback against the people who are homeless and a reaction against the city to say, you said you did homelessness and you didn't do it. And this is a question, this is a broad question, but what are we going to do to convince the public that what happened here was not a failure of government, but rather a failure of Republican government?
Well, I think it's going to take being able to communicate that message to the larger audience and to be able to have things put into context in a way that people understand that this is a problem that our entire community faces. You know, I have a lot of faith in Portland as itself. I don't necessarily believe that the residential communities in Portland aren't dealing with this problem. If you look at the Buckman neighborhood, if you look at different areas of the city that have long had individuals experiencing homelessness in their neighborhoods, I think what you're going to see is, again, what has continued to happen in different geographical regions of the city where you have the pot overflows. And so you're going to have different regions of the city that may be already engaged to some degree with individuals on the streets that are throughout the entire Portland region. But I think you're going to have these pockets of neighborhoods that are going to be dealing with an overwhelming amount of individuals. Now, that's not to say that we can't create solutions that allow for individuals to be in different areas. That's not to say that a scenario might happen where enforcement is drawn back or taken into taken into context of what's actually happened and do something different. So there's a lot of different things that could happen. So that's that individuals expanding into residential neighborhoods through some of the enforcement is one scenario. And you know, I think it's important to put things into context. Is, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, individuals on the streets had a lot of different neighborhoods to access to be able to kind of be out of sight, out of mind. You had the Pearl District, which was largely an industrial warehouse district. You had South Waterfront, where there were a lot of camps and there wasn't the residential development that there is now. I think you see the same thing happening with the Inner East Side. And I think to put things into context, it's a matter, you know, this is one part of gentrification, but the idea that where people have traditionally slept have actually become residential neighborhoods mm-hmm. and are being pushed out of those areas. So it's very ironic.
Yeah, I guess, you know, and you just said it here, but I'm going to say it again more plainly. They were residential neighborhoods. People just didn't have a house that they were staying in.
That's correct.
Yeah. One of the other fascinating things that you uncovered in this article is a backroom negotiation that's going on right now between PDC, the Portland Parks, and this private security, the PPI. Talk to our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, it's actually between Parks and PDC, and then I believe ODOT and PDOT are at the table. So I don't think PPI is actually involved in these negotiations, but right now, the Portland Petroleum Incorporated, which has been largely covered by a multitude of different media in Portland have the capacity to give park exclusions. And in 2007, they gave over 2,000 park exclusions.
What's a park exclusion?
A park exclusion is basically a 30-day exclusion for 30 to 180 days for breaking park rules. And that could be anywhere from sleeping to smoking to littering to ultimately just being in a park.
So, smoking cigarettes?
I believe individuals on the streets would have, I guess they would be getting littering tickets if there weren't trash cans in those parking, in those parks. But there's a variety. We don't know actually why they're getting park exclusions. That's one of the fascinating things is they're getting park exclusions, but they could be breaking any number of park rules that aren't tracked by the Parks Department or by PPI on why exactly individuals are getting excluded. And so we believe that the large majority of individuals being excluded from Portland parks and downtown core are people experiencing homelessness. The PPI currently have a contract with the Portland Business Alliance via the city of Portland to patrol the parks in downtown and on the East Bank Esplanade. So currently the Portland Patrol Incorporated have the capacity to give park exclusions on the East Bank Esplanade. One of the interesting things that's happening is most of the parking lots that are adjacent to the East Bank Esplanade are leased by PDC. And what's happening right now is they're under negotiations to bring that area into Parks Department-owned land so that it would actually create a situation where potentially the Portland Patrol would have a vast swath of land to be able to enforce park exclusions that are on the east side. So
in simpler terms, the PDC is thinking of transferring land over to the park, and it appears that their motivation would be that this would allow the private security force to give these park exclusions and move these camps that are emerging on the east side out.
The Parks Department denied that conclusion. The PDC, actually, a spokesperson for the PDC communicated with Street Roots that the only reason they're in negotiations is about law enforcement and what laws can be enforced where. The PPI declined to comment. But ultimately, from talking more in depth off the record and on the record with a multitude of individuals involved in touching negotiations, it's clear that that's one of the main key components that they are transferring the land.
Well, that gets me riled up, to say the least. I mean, the idea that we would use precious public resources of land, I mean, we need more parks, but to create a park not for recreation, but in fact to limit the citizens of Portland and be able to enjoy their lives, that gets me fired up.
Yeah. And, you know, to put things in a little bit of context, the police bureau currently is put in really a no-win situation with working with individuals on the streets in the context of criminalization. They're sworn officers to enforce bad policy around homelessness. And what's ended up happening is police duties are being transferred over to private security agencies in downtown in the context of working with homelessness, in the context of working with a lot of livability issues. So the police bureau either A, doesn't have the capacity to do police work, or B, they don't want to do police work, and the city has chosen to really give these duties over to a private security agency. So again, it all starts with the legislation, though. The city hall has yet to show any leadership about these particular issues that continue to build, and we continue to see Phoenixes just rise up off of the streets, angry about the way they're being treated and the civil rights of individuals on the streets. And I'm not sure they're hearing the message from the people.
So, where do you see this going? What do you see happening with this growing group of people on the east side of the river? Do you think that they will be effectively shuffled on, or is there some kind of organizing or genesis among the folks there that they might be able to say have another protest at City Hall? Or
yeah, I definitely in my 10 years of working on the streets, there's only two times that I've seen the amount of actual organizing from people on the streets happening, and one that was surrounded by Dignity Village when Dignity Village came about, the tent city here in Portland. And a lot of people call that the perfect storm that happened to be able to obtain that tent city. I think right now I would quantify it as scattered showers. So you have a lot of very smart individuals on the streets that over the past 6 months, through the City Hall protests, through working with other organizations, through educating themselves, have become very knowledgeable of the laws of why things are happening the way they are happening. And so you really see a sense of individuals organizing other individuals on the streets. And that comes out in the form of creating trash cleanup, communicating with one another to be able to advocate for themselves at city council meetings. And obviously, I think that you'll again see direct action this year by people on the streets. And I think that there'll be another moment where individuals do actually come together and protest in a more organized fashion, similar to the three-week protest, because I think that it's a no-win situation and individuals are being educated. Saying that, there are a lot of individuals on the streets that for one reason or another may be dealing with an addiction, a mental health issue. They're dealing with all these different survival factors that they're not necessarily interested in engaging the city or engaging law enforcement in a way that says, hey, I have my rights, I'm going to do this. So you have really two different components on the streets that things are playing out, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Well, we definitely look forward to the continued coverage in Street Roots, and I really appreciate all the work that you all do in bringing the news of the streets forward. Certainly, we haven't seen this story picked up, really, in the mainstream media, and as you said, we've heard a whole lot of silence from City Hall on this subject. I guess, while I have you on the air, we're about to wrap up, I'm also going to issue you an apology on behalf of the KWU that I represent, because on Monday night, on this very same radio station, I thought there was a pretty harsh piece on the Street Roots vendor program. And I think there was a misunderstanding by the host as to what the nature of Street Roots is. And from everything that that I've ever understood about the newspaper and the vendor program, I think that the work that you're doing is excellent and absolutely a lead contributor to the progressive movement here in town. So I don't think that you needed any apology, as it were. I think you handled the questions well, and I think the issue is resolved. But I'm going to get in touch with the host of that show, but I felt I wanted to say something on air because I really didn't like that characterization of the paper.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody has the right to ask questions. I think that they were legitimate questions. I think they were just a little possibly out of touch with what's actually happening on the street. So
no,
it is what it is. I don't think that we took it in a way that was negative. We just we field those questions. We're a newspaper, and we ask hard questions all the time, and we expect other people to ask hard questions as well. So
well, and I know you didn't really expect me to bring this part up on the air too, but. But I love Street Roots, and you know, and I protect those I love. So that's just
well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, hey, it's always wonderful to have you on the show again. Keep up the work. We look forward to next time you're on. So we're going to take a musical break here, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to hear about the increasing numbers of students in Oregon public schools trying to get an education while homeless.
Someone alone in the rain. Leaves have turned the color of flames out of my hand. Saturday night at the comic store, they'll close soon. In the rain. taste the mint in chocolate. Tell, tell. Awkward silence and a good night. There is no point that it all boils down to. If the point ain't real, anonymous, 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 anonymous. Noticed with a charm life, cut holes, keep away from sharp knives. Of some things that you have heard of, covered from the cold of an absent mind. Going for a walk, wake up.
That was John McDonald with Anonymous. So this next portion of the show, we had some very alarming news released this morning by the Department of Education. Last year, enrolled in Oregon schools were 15,859 students who are homeless for at least part of the year. That's 3% of the overall student body and nearly double the number of students experiencing homelessness when those numbers were counted just 5 years ago. So tonight I am joined by Donna Bolt with the Department of Education. Donna, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Hi, Donna. How are you doing?
Great.
Good. Also in the studio, I have Jesse Beeson of the Portland Community Land Trust. Good evening, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show. So, Donna, I want to start with you. To tell the listeners a little bit more about these numbers. Why are we seeing this increase? Where are these kids who are homeless? Are they concentrated in certain school districts? Give our listeners the big picture of what's going on.
The McKinney-Vento Act, which is a federal act to assist homeless people, has a portion that is dedicated to public school education rights of homeless children and youth. And so we've been collecting data by school district on the numbers of kids that are enrolled in school that are eligible as homeless. We've been doing this uniformly for the past 5 years, since 2003 to 2004. At that time, there were just over 8,000 kids counted in the 197 districts we have in Oregon. And as Michael said, those numbers have almost doubled now. In 2007-2008, for last school year. Somebody asked me earlier today, where do homeless children come from? And my answer was, they come from homeless families. We have a lot of homeless families. We've been shortchanging them on housing for a while. There's not enough affordable housing for low-income people. There's been a lot of distress in the housing market, the foreclosure rates, the payday loan companies, a lot of different scams have sort of put people over the brink. And I think a lot of that is seen in these numbers climbing as rapidly as they have been.
So now half these kids that are homeless, or nearly half these kids that are homeless, are in K through 5.
Yeah.
That seems like a tremendous number. What's the impact on young kids of not having a stable place to call home or having to switch schools?
Well, there's a loss of educational progress every time a child changes schools. Even a child in an affluent family, when they change schools more than once during the school year, they lose educational progress. They have to make new friends. They have to do their schoolwork in different environments. Perhaps they're in a different place in the curriculum in the new school. it just disrupts their life enough that they can't keep up with their peers in most cases, unless they're very, very exceptional students. I think you also need to look at the kids that are pre-K, the kids from birth until age 5, when a lot of very important brain development is going on. And when kids are homeless, when infants and toddlers are homeless, the stress that is consistent with homelessness, the hunger, the fear of losing housing and parents and pets, all of that combines, even though the kids may not even be able to verbalize it yet, but it stresses them out and their usual brain development is sometimes inhibited by that fear. It's almost like PTSD sometimes. But during those early years when the synapses and the dendrites and the neurons are all trying to become hardwired so that child is ready to learn how to read, if there's a lot of disruption happening, then that hardwiring is not going to occur. And, you know, that's like a time bomb for a kindergarten or a first grade teacher. This is a kid who's been under so much stress, they're not ready to learn yet, and there has to be a lot of intervention and accommodation made so that they can keep up with their childhood peers in the classroom.
So we've heard a lot from the federal government about the plan to end homelessness. We've heard a lot about No Child Left Behind. Talk about what federal programs are doing to offset this this growth of families who are homeless.
The federal programs, under the No Child Left Behind Act, one of the important things that they did was to recognize that the McKinney-Vento education program had a place in public education, and they actually made that a title under the No Child Left Behind Act. And so regardless of what people think about the No Child Left Behind Act in general and some of the extra punitive measures that are taken there, they did adopt the McKinney-Vento Act, which I thought was a really good move. Allowed every school district to participate in homelessness assistance by having a liaison in every school district who is hopefully trained in how to identify and work with these kids, and also to help us count them and so that we can make reports like this and tell people how alarming these numbers are. In relation to the 10-year plans to end homelessness, Michael, I think you'll agree with me that when it first started, this was, as you said in the first segment, focused very much on chronically homeless single adults who are out on the streets and visible to the public. And it did that in spite of the fact you've got hidden families that are in people's garages or who are sleeping in cars, possibly in motels, weekly rates motels, very overcrowded situations, shacking up in really horrible abandoned barns and sheds and things like that. The initial 10-year plan federally really, I think, took the wrong approach by concentrating on one particular portion of the population to the neglect of the rest. I think now in Oregon, though, people are realizing that that's not the way we're going to go. Oregon's different, and our community needs assessments are showing that it's families that need affordable housing. Over half of Oregon school districts are rural and are very small, and they don't have the same issues that the metro cities do. They're looking for family housing and ways to help large families bring up kids that will succeed in school and attain their high school diploma and go on to college or into a vocation that is suited for them.
One of the things that's going on here in Oregon is that the Statewide Housing Alliance, a broad advocacy coalition of over 60 organizations, is making a move in the legislature to get more funding that would help address the problems that these homeless families are facing. Jesse, what is the Housing Alliance proposing as a solution?
Well, the Oregon Housing Alliance is proposing a series of public investments in the housing spectrum to really provide places for families to go and individuals to go when the markets really price them out. And so this during the 2009 legislative session, we're asking for $100 million of public investment, including the creation of a document recording fee, which would add a small, modest fee to real estate transactions, but would generate a huge amount of revenue that would have a great impact in communities across Oregon in terms of providing buy-down assistance or rental assistance for families to be able to find an affordable place to live.
And this was a proposal that the Housing Alliance championed in 2007
that
just fell short. Talk about why it's so important for the kids who are suffering right now that we get this kind of relief from the state.
Well, I think, you know, one of the largest indicators of school success is stability. And having this mobile student population, and I think Donna spoke to a lot of this earlier, when you're moving three times in a school year, you start to fall behind your peers pretty quickly. And if you have a stable home, if you know that you're going to be in school for at least that entire year, if not the same elementary school throughout your primary schooling, then you have the ability to focus on the future. And you have the ability to not just get by, but get ahead in school. And so, you know, the work that we do in the Housing Alliance and the work that I do in my own particular organization is about creating that stability for families and for children.
One of the things that I always think is interesting is the different way on social issues we have been we think of issues in isolation. You know,
exactly.
We talk about the test scores. You know, the kids are struggling with the test scores. What's wrong with those teachers? Well, it would seem to me that if 3% of the population of students is experiencing homelessness, maybe we should stop looking at the teachers and start looking at this problem.
I think it's entirely true. You know, we have friends who are teachers, and they attest that they spend a lot of their time dealing with issues outside of the classroom, because really it's about the home that you're going to, or in this case, not going to, that is dictating a lot of your ability to concentrate, your ability to learn, and your ability to really get ahead.
I want to move now to talk a little bit about some of the specific school districts around the school and around the state. I want to start outside of Portland and then come back to Portland. But first, Donna, one of the things that just blew me away when I was looking at this press release this morning is that the school district that came in second in the largest number of homeless students was Medford, and almost 10% of the enrolled students are homeless in Medford. Is that correct?
Medford has been plagued by poverty for many years. I remember visiting Medford about 5 years ago and going out early in the morning, like around 7 o'clock, and there was a line around the plasma center where they pay you to give blood. And this was 2 hours before the plasma center opened. That's how hard hit people have been in Medford and the surrounding area, Jacksonville. A lot of the open areas around Medford and then all the way up to Eagle Point and places like that. There's been a loss of jobs there that has not recovered in the past 5 years, and it's just been very difficult for people in poverty in that area to find housing and to find stability. On the other hand, you've got this really great school district program in the Medford area, the Maslow Project, and it, including what they do with K-12 students that they would see in a normal school day. They also have an outreach center for kids who've already dropped out of school or who are on the streets, and they use the Maslow hierarchy in order to proceed with their program, taking care of the survival needs of the youth first and getting them food and shelter and clothing, showers, hygiene, whatever. They're taking care of those needs while they're also counseling and encouraging these kids to get back into school and work toward a diploma, because that's their ticket out of poverty. And they've just brought in a lot of kids into the system just by doing incredible outreach. And this is going to really help that community in the future, because there hopefully will not be so many people at loose ends when they are graduating kids more frequently who are in poverty, graduating them out of school and into colleges and into the job universe.
Another huge issue that seems to me true for Medford, and certainly this is an issue in Ben Lapine and some of the coastal communities, is that just as you described, it's a community without jobs, enough jobs with good wages, but then on top of that, it's a super hot real estate market.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like that puts a horrible crunch on a family's budget and ability to survive.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a lot of affluent folks that are moving into places like Bend and moving into houses in the six-figure ranges. And the rate of the development of that kind of affluent housing really is much greater than affordable housing, and in some places it's displacing the affordable housing that used to be there. It's a nice place to retire to. Oregon is a beautiful place with a very temperate climate, and so we do see a lot of retirees moving to the coast or to southern Oregon. And they're not necessarily the ones with kids, and they're not necessarily the ones that are voting for the school bonds, and oftentimes they're either complacent or they're dispassionate about homeless children in general and would rather see them out of the way.
It brings to mind that media euphemism that we often hear around war, collateral damage. You know, of course, we live in a hot housing market right here in Portland. And as a matter of fact, I think we've been seeing a trend of families struggling to stay in this city for quite some time. Certainly, Jesse, at the Portland Community Land Trust, your organization is geared towards giving families a chance to compete in this difficult real estate market.
It's true. You know, the average home in our region is selling for about $300,000, if not a little bit more. And, you know, families just can't afford that. And that price puts pressure not just on the real estate market, but also the rental market, as we start to lose more and more units to ownership from rental. That pushes families out to places where they have to commute even further, and they're changing schools 2-3 times a year because of that rental market, or because of foreclosure, or because of job loss. And certainly, you know, my organization is focused on giving people ownership opportunities to really create stability in particular neighborhoods. And, you know, that's why we try to sell homes for half the average price, around $130,000. But whether it's rental or ownership, the issue still stands that this market is pricing families out of it and forcing them to sleep on couches and to sleep in the garages or jack up with the grandparents. And I think that, you know, there is something that we can do about it. And I think in the 09 legislature, if we go down and really work in coalition with school groups, with housing groups, with economic development groups, with hunger groups, really pointing at this pillar issue of stable housing and making the case for investment, you know, I think we can be successful.
You know, and I think this is one of those things. I mean, we're on the air, but, you know, hey, I can't help but thinking of connections to be made. And Donna, you and I have together been working for years about coordinating and getting the school liaisons more involved in some of the broader advocacy efforts. But boy, oh boy, it seems like we've had an increase almost twofold in the last 5 years. If it isn't time for us to figure out how to get together and organize and get something done in Salem, I don't know when it is. Donna, could you talk a little bit about, I think Jesse absolutely sketched out the picture that we in Portland, if you've been paying attention, know all too well, families are getting priced out. But some of the numbers from your press release really seem to illustrate the school districts that those families are being pushed to.
You're right, and it's especially not just in the press release, but in the actual data spreadsheets, you can see that numbers are increasing in suburban areas around the metro area decreasing in the inner city in terms of homeless families and their schools where they're living. A lot of times they'll be living in a shelter in Portland, and they'll actually be going to school in Beaverton because that's where they were originally going to school before they became homeless, but they couldn't find a shelter until they got into Portland. And vice versa, you'll find a lot of people who will be actually going to school in Portland. However, the only place they could find to live was in Hillsborough or Beaverton or Gladstone or Gresham Barlow. And while they still attend school in Portland, they're bused every day back out to the suburbs where they have been able to find housing or with a relative or some friends or what have you.
When you say bused every day, is that transportation that's attached to the schools, or are these kids having to get themselves to and from relying on public transportation?
Now, one of the beautiful things about the McKinney-Vento Education Program is that children and youth who are homeless are allowed to remain at their school of origin, the school that they were originally attending when they became homeless, if it's feasible. And feasibility is more along the lines of how long is that bus ride or how long does it take them, how many changes do they have to make on buses or in taxis or whatever. It's not based on cost. You can't say it's too expensive to send these kids back to their school of origin. That's not a reason. That's not a good enough reason. It has to be, we can't send this child back to the school of origin because he'll be on the bus for 4 hours each day, and that's not in his or her best educational interest. But McKinney enforces that and allows that right for these children that are lifted out of their homes and placed elsewhere. It also helps kids in temporary foster care settings to have that school of origin opportunity as well. I mean, if you think of a meth bust where law enforcement has cracked down on several meth-producing...
You said meth bust.
Methamphetamine.
Okay. I thought you said meth bus. I was like, what kind of buses are they taking these
kids
on?
Oh, yeah, right. No. If law enforcement would come in and enter the homes of where they have... are aware of methamphetamine cooking or production or manufacture. A lot of times there are young children living there who are pulled out of that home in the middle of the night where their parents are marched off to jail. And these kids go to temporary foster homes. A lot of people open their arms and allow these kids to come live with them until they can find a relative or someone else, a safe place for the those children to live. And one of the things McKinney does is allow those kids to stay at the school they were attending, so at least one thing in their life is not changing. They have the stability of seeing their friends and their teachers at school, and even though the rest of their life is a horrible mess, they do have that contact with something they know and is consistent and a strong part of their lives.
You know, and that is really a wonderful program, and I have to say, you know, it gives a good backstop to a broken housing system. You know, and what I would love to see is us to get to a place where we could have enough resources on the front end so we weren't trying to bail kids out. You know, I mean, I certainly we're a ways away from that, but I think that's what we're all working towards here. So as always happens on the show, all of a sudden we're getting to the place where we're about to wrap up, and there's a lot of other places we could go with this. But what I want to make sure is two things. One is, Jesse, if people want to get involved with the Housing Alliance, how would they do that? Where can they find out more information about ways that we can change the situation for students in Oregon?
Well, it's pretty simple. We have a great website at www.OregonHousingAlliance.org, or you can call 503-226-3001 and just ask for Allison. We would love to have as many people involved down talking to their representatives, to people in the legislature about the importance of this. As has been demonstrated, even in the Portland region alone, we have enough homeless kids to fill a high school, and that's just not okay.
Yeah, Well said. Donna, if there's things that our listening audience wants to do over the short term, say they want to get involved in their school district and maybe volunteer time with one of the McKinney liaisons, is there a way that they can get involved easily, or should they just call the school district?
That would be the shortest way, calling the school district administrative office and asking to speak to the liaison for homeless students. And if need be, if you're not aware of which school district you're in or which school districts are available in your area, then you can give me a call at the state, or you can go to my website. My website is www.ode.state.or.us/go/homelessed, one word. And you can call me on the phone, too, at 503-947-5781, and I can direct you to who the liaisons and other staff are in your area. They really can use a lot of volunteers, and, of course, they can use donations to help kids get clothing and shoes in order to go to school. Thanks a lot for allowing me to plug that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I really appreciate and admire the work of both of you. And please keep it up. And Donna, I'm telling you, the day that I get to have you on the show and you're telling me the numbers have gone down is going to be a day that we're going to have a big party.
All right.
Well, take care, guys. This is the end of Hole in the Bucket for September 10th. You've been listening to KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. Thanks much to Sean Ongley, our great engineer. And let's go out rocking in the free world.
Sleeping in their shoes, but there's a warning sign on the road ahead. There's a lot of people saying we'd be better off dead. Don't feel like Satan, but I am to them, so I try to forget it any way I can. Keep on rocking in the free world.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
September 11th, 35 years ago. A coup brings dictator Augusto Pinochet to power in Chile. Tens of thousands were murdered or disappeared. Among those, American Charles Horman, whose story was told in the award-winning movie, Missing. This Friday, September 12th,